right, it's the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On this week's episode, BA food director Carla Lolly Music sits down with chef and restaurateur Barbara Lynch. Barbara owns Number 9 Park, B&G Oyster, Sportella, among several other restaurants up in Boston. And she was just named one of the 100 most influential people in the world on Time Magazine's annual list. The only chef to make the list this year. And she just came out with a memoir called Out of Line, A Life of Playing with Fire, about a pretty rough childhood growing up in Boston and then how she transitioned to becoming a local hero. Carla and Barbara talk about that transition, about her Italian-leaning food, and the time Barbara stole a bus as a teenager. All right, let's do this.
I asked one of our food editors in the test kitchen before I came down here. I told them that I was going to be interviewing Boston famous chef around the world, Barbara Lynch, and what questions they wanted me to ask you. And Andy Baragani looked at me and said, ask her how you become a legend.
Oh, geez, I don't know.
And when he asked me this question, I didn't even know that you had been named on the Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World.
Right.
Are you the only chef on the list this year?
I think I was, yeah.
What got you on that list?
I think it was my nickname, Knuckles Lynch. I don't know. I really don't know. You know, it could be part of the book. I think mentoring maybe, or giving back. I have no idea, really.
And when you say the book, you're talking about?
Oh, my memoir.
Out of Line, memoir just came out.
Correct.
And do you feel like you had to get to a certain place in your career to even have the thought of having a memoir? I feel like you have a memoir when you're like, I have a life's worth of awesomeness to talk about.
Right. I thought I had to be 80.
80-ish.
Mm. I had to Google it, actually. Memoir? I'm way too young for that. What comes after that? Like the Lifetime Achievement Award? I have no idea. But actually, it was very therapeutic to write it. I didn't want to write a memoir, but my agent, I didn't even have an agent then, and she read a story about me in the New York Times about 6 years ago and came to Boston, and she was really persistent that I write this book because of what it will do to help other people.
And what is that?
To make people feel like, just to inspire and to let them know that they can do anything. Like, if I can do what I did, coming from where I came from, anybody can do anything.
All right, so let's back up and talk about that, because you came from South Boston,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of people's only kind of crossover familiarity with that world is from watching movies.
Yeah, usually mafia men, and they sort of make the mafia look good or tough, and that looks good.
Right.
Right.
So how would you describe where you grew up?
Tough, blue collar, heavily Irish part of Boston.
And your upbringing, and I admit to not having read the entire memoir because I only got it yesterday, but, you know, that's just the busy life we're living in.
I think we're in the weeds.
We're in the weeds. I'm totally
not the
in the weeds.
I
have like seven books in various stages of being read right now.
This one's a good read. You can do it.
Yeah, this is, well, very conversational. And you didn't have a typical sort of childhood.
No, we come from very humble upbringings. My mother was a widow, six kids. My father died a month before I was born.
Wow.
We grew up in a housing project. She literally worked like three or four jobs just to keep us off welfare. She wasn't a great cook.
Okay.
Oh, she made a mean-ass tuna fish sandwich,
mm-hmm.
with pickles, great spaghetti and meatballs. But you know, I mean, she was a busy, busy, busy lady. You know, she couldn't afford to send us off to camp in the summer. So I was a pretty creative kid.
And you were the youngest of six.
Oh, yeah.
With boys, sisters and brothers.
Correct.
And did they share in the responsibility of raising you? Or was it like, when you can walk, you're on your own?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
I read that you stole a bus when you were 13.
I did.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How did you knew how to drive it, or you just figured I'll figure it out when I get in there?
Yeah.
Where were you going?
The steering wheel was bigger than my head. I, you know, you don't sit on the seat. You just, it was idling at the bus stop at Broadway Station. I pulled a clutch and I used to try to drive my brother's little mini. It was like a, 2002.
Uh-huh.
BMW.
That was my first car.
Mine too.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Are you a Pisces?
No. Leo.
Ah.
But what does that have to do with that?
I don't know. We have similarities.
I have no idea. It was the car that my mom was driven to the hospital in to give birth to me. And then when I went to college, my parents still had the car. They gave me the car. Anyway, 2002. So your brother had one.
But mine was a BMW too, 2002. And I never had a driver's license, but I won $1,800 playing blackjack.
Okay.
And I went up to Route 1 in Peabody, Massachusetts. And I waited at Louis BMW and he gave me my car. I had no driver's license, no driving experience. And I'm riding down Route 1. It said BMW. I'm like, build my world.
Awesome.
Right? So anyway, I knew about the clutch and the thing at age, what?
13.
So yeah, we got about a half a mile, quarter mile.
Who's we?
Oh, my friends and I.
And this is a school bus or like a city bus?
MBTA or
cool. You'd pick any customers up along the route.
No, we were laughing so hard. I just had to get out.
So like, it was just an adventure.
Yeah, and then we're like, "Fuck,
right,
let's get out." And we left it right in the middle of the street and ran.
Cool.
To the D Street projects.
Did you get busted?
No, God, no. I had luck. God was on my side, man. I didn't get arrested in anything I did, which half of it isn't in the book, which is a good thing.
Right. Yeah. You sold drugs?
Briefly.
Briefly.
For my sister.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there was stealing and there was just like basic sort of.
But I was canning too. I went canning. I put like craft paper in a can, or a Schlitz can, made my friends do it too. Collecting money for band uniforms.
Got it.
We would go door to door for some cash to go eat the fried clams at Hojo's. But then a little old lady called my mother and she said, "Now, Barbara, I didn't know your daughter was in a band." My mother's like, "She doesn't know how to fucking play an instrument."
And band of thieves.
Yeah, right.
Hooligans.
Hooligans. So my mother's like, waiting for me to come home. She's like, "What were you doing all day?" And I said, "Nothing." She's like, "Where's your money?" And so I had to give it all back. I'm like, "Ma, Diane Ben is going to eat all the fried clams at fucking Hojo's." So I was home from, I had to stay in for a while.
So, like I said, not the traditional necessarily image of childhood that we have in our minds, but
no,
very real. And you obviously weren't the only kid who had this experience, but you grew up, you didn't finish high school, your mom didn't cook. How did you end up in restaurants?
Well, I guess I knew if I could cook, I'd always have a job.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think I'd get this far.
So
I figured I'd have a sub shop or a steak tip joint.
And that was that the goal when you got into your first kitchen? Like, I'm just going to figure out how to make food, sell food,
mm-hmm.
eat food,
mm-hmm.
and I can make it happen.
Well, I think I wanted to make people happy by cooking food.
And how did you know that would do that? When did you learn that like you could cook and that had this effect?
I think it was pretty much my first job. Actually, I think it was 13 when I made my first pesto sauce.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Well, I stole the pine nuts. But later on in life, I went back down to the store where I stole them and I gave them the money for the pine nuts.
Really?
I'm such a Catholic girl, right? I just didn't want to feel guilty.
How did you know what pesto was? So, I mean, is
it
something you had?
Bon Appetit.
Stop.
No, I'm not
really?
Kidding. Yeah. Back then, yeah.
That's amazing.
Bon Appetit in Gourmet magazine. That's all I would read.
Wow. So you read about this pesto. You had to get your hands on some pine nuts.
And basil. And basil, believe it or not, was really exotic.
Really?
In South Boston, yeah.
Where'd you finally find it?
In the North End.
Oh, really?
Correct.
And you get back home.
No, I went to my friend's house. She was in AA at 13. So she had her group of people over. And I used Prince spaghetti, but I made the pesto at her house with garlic, fresh grated cheese,
wow,
basil, and the stolen pine nuts. And they loved it. They're like, "What is it though? It's green. I don't know what this is, but it's delicious." So, you know, I made them happy, and that was fun. That was, I knew then I wanted to be a chef.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
At 13?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you get into restaurants at a very young age.
Yeah.
And your education actually came like...
By fire.
Right.
Right.
Like, and who was the first chef who gave you...
Playing with fire.
This is the subtitle of this memoir. Who's the first chef or business owner who gave you that shot?
I guess I'm going to have to say Todd English. I only worked for him for 8 years.
For 8 years at at Fig and Olives?
Yeah. Well, first Michaela's in Cambridge.
Okay.
And then at Olives before it was Figs, the little one.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ran Figs for 2 years.
And that so was like this
my
is where...
first real opportunity to open a restaurant. So he, you know, I did it all.
And that was in the last 2 years of working together that you...
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning, how much did you know about Italian food,
nothing.
Restaurant service?
Ooh, nothing. I used to read like the Foods of Waverly Route from Andrew Square to Harvard Square, which is a good half an hour train ride.
Uh-huh.
Like I had to catch up.
And that was your education, was the... being in the restaurant and then filling in with cookbooks, Waverly Route.
He made me a chef right away at Michaela's. Like, I was a chef in the cafe. Everything was, like, $16.99. And everything was cooked in a Hobart oven.
Yeah.
Like, everything got baked in these clay dishes.
Right.
And he was a fucking screamer. Oh, my God. He was
really
so tough. Yeah.
But was that, like, did that just bounce right off of you?
Well, it didn't really bother me because... for me, I'm like, oh, shut up. You know,
right.
I'll kill you. Just push it again. Push the button again.
But, did it ever come down? Did you ever push back?
No, I would just like flip him the finger and behind his back.
Right. And go about.
He'd be like, Lynch, you really need to get like organized. I'm like, I'm never organized. And then he'd just scream at me again. I don't think he really knew what to do with me. But the beauty was that I could cook like a mad woman. So he couldn't really fire me.
But he didn't know that, you know, talk to me about how you like that first meeting. Did you ring the service bell? Did you show up with a resume?
Oh my God.
How did you get in? How did you kick that door open?
I wouldn't even call him. Like I met a sous chef, his sous chef at a party in Cambridge. I was working at the Harvest, but I was only there for 4 months. And his sous chef said, wow, you'd be perfect at Michaela's. Would you ever come in for an interview? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll come in. So I gave him my phone number. I was still living with my mother. And the sous chef called me a couple of times, and I never called him back. And then Todd English called a couple of times, and I never called him back.
Why didn't you call back?
I don't know. I just wasn't ready.
Okay. So but you knew who he was, and you knew that this was...
I didn't even know who Todd English was. But my mother, you know, of course, she answers the phone.
Right.
She wouldn't take a note down.
She's like, who's Todd?
Yeah, who's this Todd English? And then once I answered the phone, this is before cell phones.
Oh, yeah.
And answering machines.
Clearly.
She used to have her little notebook and she'd sit there in her recliner in her house coat. So I answered the phone once and it was Todd. It's like, hey, this is Todd English. You ever going to come in for an interview? I'm like, all right, sure. Give me the address. 2.5 hours it took me to find this friggin' restaurant.
Really?
So I was 2.5 hours late. Finally, this 6'4" guy comes. And I'm looking at him. And I had long hair and blue eyeshadow. And I was like, I looked at him and I said, who the fuck would put a restaurant here? He's like, oh, you're sassy. And I was like, yeah. And then he hired me.
Wow.
And then I quit my job at the Harvest, which I never do. Just quit. Didn't show up for work the next day. And I was working at Michaela's the next day.
So literally based on that exchange, he hires you.
Yeah.
Because why?
I think it's because I was sassy.
Yeah. You're a tough cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And
Knuckles. Lynch.
Knuckles. Yeah. Right. That's good.
I'm really a softie.
I've heard you, I read that you had said that before. I watched actually a very endearing video of you cooking, and you talked about being a softie.
Mm-hmm.
But you obviously have a tough exterior.
Right.
Enjoy cursing.
When you read the book, you'll know I'm really
deep down.
Deep down, got a heart.
And you carry it to this day?
I think I'm actually softer No.
Are your chefs afraid of you in the kitchen? If you walk in the kitchen, do you get that immediately? Everybody ties their apron a little bit tighter and sweeps off the counter.
Floor, yeah. The code word is turkey on the gravy.
Oh, turkey on the gravy.
Mm-hmm. That's the code word.
Now. Right, for that you're coming down the hall.
Yeah.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey on the gravy. I'm trying to remember. I worked at Union Pacific and we had a code also for, and it was this long service entrance. So there was like a good, 20 seconds before the chef would walk in. And I can't remember, but the sous chef would pick up the phone, hang up, immediately call to the dishwashers to sweep the floor. And like we all, just as soon as he said that, we all knew the chef was coming.
Yeah.
So you get that. And you still cook on the line. You're still in the kitchen.
I'm still in the kitchen. I try not to cook on the line because I'll drive them crazy. But there are, if somebody is royally screwing up, I'll hop on the line.
Yeah. And at this point, you have your own group or group O.
Mm-hmm. What I do is usually take the CDCs or executive sous to my house and we cook.
Cook together.
Not all together. Like right. I take one at a time.
Right. But you and your chef de cuisine, you're cooking
them,
together.
Get to really know them and to see their style of cooking and see where they need help. And then really get to know them. And
do you rely on them to innovate or come up with new ideas? Or do you kind of know exactly what you want?
Well, I don't allow them to really veer off of French and Italian. Mm-hmm. So, I just have a huge collection of cookbooks, and I inspire them to stay the course.
Yeah.
And then you can create from there.
Got it.
There are staples that we can't take off.
Of your menus, because your clients would freak out.
They, boycott like nobody's business.
What are some of those dishes?
Oh, prune stuffed gnocchi, bolognese, the tagliatelle bolognese, the lamb fondue, the butter soup at Montan. The lobster roll at B&G, steak tartare.
Can't touch them.
Truffle gnocchi, no way. They won't. It's happened to me because it's kind of like I was, I got kind of tired of it. Because sometimes it takes over the whole menu.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But then I thought about it. It's like, Aretha Franklin can't stop singing.
Right.
Her one hit one.
Right.
Well, she's not a one-hit wonder, but you can't stop.
You got to give. I listened to a great interview with Tom Petty a year ago. It was great. He was great. And he said the same thing. Like, I get kind of sick of it. And like, I want to make new music. I want to perform new music. He was like, but when you're out there in the stadium and 40,000 people are singing the words to your song, like, it's pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you think about it and you're like, God, I'll never get sick of eating the prune gnocchi or making it. So then you just perfect it.
And so do you feel like those dishes, which are classics, you didn't invent them. Are they your dishes or are they dishes that you've adopted?
No, I think that's the difference. Like I did invent the prune gnocchi. I mean, I didn't invent the potato part or the gnocchi part, but I did invent that part. Like the putting a prune in a pasta and foie gras sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part I'm proud of.
And so you have a reverence for like these classic techniques, but not that they would have to be executed the same way. But at the same time, you've got a tagliatelle bolognese, which is...
Yeah, I didn't invent
how
that.
Much, right.
But shitloads of chicken livers, yes.
Right.
It's a must.
Right.
And sage.
Yeah, the chicken livers. Our chicken liver, we have a bolognese on our classics recipes. And the chicken livers make people... really pissed.
Why?
I don't know. People don't expect that to be there, think it's gross, and are angry.
Well, that's a shame.
I know, because it's like you need that.
Get over it.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
you know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works. Yeah. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So working for Todd English, poring over cookbooks, and then travel. Can you talk about the travel piece and how that changed you as a chef?
Well, I think travel's important. Coming from a kid from Salty who never went anywhere. But I think Italy was like my most favorite trip of all. Like going over there for the first time was like a little kid. You know, you're just like a sponge and you're taking it all in. And I think what I fell in love with was just the culture first. Families. They weren't as chaotic as mine.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually liked each other. Mm-hmm. it was all based around food and the mother in the kitchen kind of thing. And it wasn't about a title or how much money you have or you don't have. It was like just a very self-sufficient, like they lived off the farm.
Right.
It was great.
What part of Italy was this?
Teverina in Tuscany. Actually, it was Sarah Jenkins. Do you know Sarah?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was her parents' farm.
Amazing.
Cortona.
And so you were able to stay there and like just really soak it up?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Around there.
And you've been back many times.
Oh, yeah.
So actually the first time I met you, you may not remember, it was like 5 or 6 years ago, but I came to learn how to make carbonara from you. And
we were in Stir.
Yeah, and we were at Stir. And
Pecor. We made the little
It was from a trip that you had made to Rome where you were sort of like hell-bent on finding the best carbonara.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the first one you ate while you were there.
Pirelli's.
Yeah, yeah. At Pirelli's. So that recipe has like become a classic at Bon Appetit. People make it all the time.
Oh, good.
But you were an amazing teacher, I felt. And I only spent, you know, an hour or two with you.
I was?
Yeah, you were the incredibly descriptive. It was based on, you know, a memory of a dish, the way you talked about the texture of the guanciale being, you know, rendered but not crisp and still juicy, but, and how many egg yolks were involved. I remember being pretty.
Always a lot.
It's like 6 egg yolks and 1 whole egg, yeah. I think, for 12 ounces of pasta.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a very special and cool day.
So you've nailed it, huh?
I mean, here's the thing that happens when I make that carbonara. When you made it, you had the guanciale in the pan, you had the eggs and the parm in the bowl, and then the pasta, I think with a spider, was going straight into the egg mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, you know, using the fat and the guanciale, tossing, tossing. And it eventually thickened enough and was like emulsified.
Mm-hmm.
And I also remember you saying like at the end of the bowl, there should be enough sauce left in the bottom of the bowl that you take that last piece of pasta and you have something to drag through, which is like, that's a great visual cue that people don't think about, you know, that way. But when I do it at home, I often feel like I have to put it back over a really low flame to get the egg to thicken enough.
Oh, no, you don't have to.
What am I doing wrong? Does the bowl have to be warm?
No. Just don't think about salmonella.
No, I mean, I don't.
All right. I don't know.
Like stays liquidy.
Maybe add a little more cheese.
Mm-hmm. Too thin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, and the pasta should be, no, you maybe add a little more cheese.
Okay.
Try that one.
Next time.
Okay.
And there were
a lot of obsessive like that. If I remember something that was so delicious, I'm going to make it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you serve carbonara at any of your restaurants?
Yeah, but I'll freak out if it's not delicious.
How often do you go in and spot check?
I try a lot. If I'm not, then they'll tell me.
Really?
Yeah.
I also wanted to talk. So you have, this is your first memoir, but you wrote a cookbook called Stir. And that was really about like teaching. Was that the beginning of you? You talked at the beginning about giving back and mentoring. Did you see that cookbook as a way of like, I know a lot of, I know a lot now, and I want other people to know what I know. Was that the impetus?
No. I mean, actually, you know, I was younger then. I don't.
It was like 2009, right?
It's like 13 years old. I think I only had like three restaurants then.
Oh, only three.
But I think as a chef, you know, and you're going to put a cookbook out, I wanted the big,
right?
You know, coffee table book. But at my editor at the time, I she was right. She's like, Barbara, I like the food that you like to cook at home.
Mm.
So she was right. And I love Stir because I think it's a doable cookbook for people to cook at home because mm-hmm. I hate cooking chef food at home.
Right.
And so I think that's the perfect cookbook.
Right.
Right. And the recipes really work. And it's nice to see that people who cook out of the book feel great about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a win-win kind of cookbook.
Right.
The recipes and the photos are beautiful. And it's, I feel like it's just a doable cookbook.
Yeah. A lot of chefs have a really hard time, I think, making that transition from the food that they cook in their restaurants that maybe has made them famous or put them on the map and the way that they really cook.
Right.
And that's something that we're constantly, whenever we're working with a chef at Bon Appetit, it's like, no. Like, right. How would you tell your sister, your mother, your cousin's neighbor, like, to make this? Because that's what we try to get at, you know, the most.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, it wasn't, was that conflict there for you? Or was it just easy to give, like, this makes sense?
No, it took me, we had a fight. My
oh, really?
And we didn't talk for a year. Rux Martin. And then I understood it.
Because you wanted a chef tome.
Right.
Right.
But then she was right. And I gave in.
And people use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Stir, which is a kind of a hybrid, right, event space and demo.
Well, it's just a demo. It's a demonstration kitchen and bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically a place where I knew I needed an office, really, because I knew I was opening three more restaurants. And I needed a place to cook in.
Right.
And make sample recipes as well. And I needed, it's actually the same kitchen I have at home, but mm-hmm. a little smaller.
Mm-hmm. And so people come there for?
7 nights a week for cooking classes.
Wow. And do people want to learn the food that they love to eat in your restaurant, or do they just want to know how to cook?
They want to know how to cook.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. That's what I love about it, because we teach them how to cook. We're not judging them.
Right.
Like reality shows.
At what point did you, or maybe you never did, but at what point did you sort of become or start to think about gender roles in the kitchen as part of being a chef?
I was just talking to somebody last night about this. Like, I guess it was the Pellegrino Award, like best mm-hmm. female chef.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't sit well with me. It wouldn't be great if it was just best chef.
Right.
Right? I think it would be great.
Yeah. It's not like a physical sport where, like, your anatomy makes a difference.
Yeah. I mean, if we continue it this way, that's not going to help anything.
Do you think about this dynamic at all when you're hiring or staffing your kitchens?
No, but, you know, if you have passion, I'm going to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd rather you don't come from another management or another kitchen.
Really?
Because I don't want to clean up your management mess. Like, if you have passion, I can teach you how to cook. And we can teach you how to be a great leader. But I don't have the time to teach you, you know,
right,
to turn you around.
Right.
But
you're not like teaching someone to unlearn bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
But you could take somebody who had maybe never mm-hmm. never cooked and teach them how to cook.
Which we do.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know? Like, you're sitting down with someone, they're a young cook. Mm-hmm. They show up, they want a job.
If they have a vision and a notebook and it's not empty and you have a vision and you have a goal, we're your team. Well, come on. We'll set you up for success. Definitely.
Is there a question that you ask anyone who comes in and wants a job with you?
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
Mm-hmm. Where's your notebook? Where do you want to be in 5 years, 10 years? What's your 5 years and 10 years? Where do you see yourself? What's your favorite cuisine?
Mm-hmm. Is there a wrong answer, or you just want to know what there?
No.
You just want to know what's there.
And then they stage in the kitchen, and then you want to see their teamwork and what their energy level is like.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Where'd you grow up and how old are you? That's it.
Are you of legal age to work in the kitchen?
Yeah, right.
Did you boost a car to get over here today?
Do you know how to hotwire a car?
These are skills people
right.
need.
Right?
It's a physical job.
Oh my God. I met the most amazing woman, and she's from Philly. She just opened the first woman-owned car mechanic shop.
Awesome. In Philly or in the world?
No, in Philly. I met her at the White House. We were speaking for a woman's, you know, small business woman entrepreneur leadership. And she was talking about, like, I was just in awe because she was just talking about, like, how she, you know, loves to fix cars. And when she would take her car to go get fixed, like, these guys would just give her a hard time and overcharge her, blah, blah, blah. So as a young kid, she said, I'm going to own my own car mechanic shop. I was like, fuck, that is awesome. I said, man, I can hotwire a car like nobody's business, but I don't know. I just don't know how to fix a car.
Right.
And we were just like friends after that. But she's doing great in Philly. She has a nail salon in it.
In the car repair place?
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
I'm like, can you open one? Can you open a Home Depot by any chance? Because I don't know anything about tools either. So
talking about mentoring, you have a daughter.
Yes, I do.
She's a teen.
13.
13. So how did your... It's hard to parent a teen. I'm just going
to
preface by
it's
saying that.
It's hard to parent in general.
It's hard to parent in general, but then like the turn to the teens, because I'm dealing with this same scenario where you're like, you are turning into a different person and I now have to figure out how to parent you. Your own childhood and upbringing, you know, how much does that inform the way that you parent? Like, are you more accepting of rule breaking? Do you expect her to break rules? Do you want her to toe the line? Like, where do you...
Oh, God. If she breaks rules, I'm like, you know, I can break rules. She can't. No, I... Oh, God. She's... No. No, I
so
expect
she,
her to be a wonderful woman in the world, a leader. I have a lot of expectations for her.
And even though you were a rule breaker and ended up being... certainly influential leader, business owner, times 100. Come on.
I raised myself. I have high expectations on myself, higher than I'll ever reach. I'm just helping her have high expectations, higher than she'll ever reach.
Right.
I'm just guiding her along. I didn't have the guidance.
Do you let her curse at home?
No.
Does she misbehave?
Yes.
She does?
She doesn't know I know it, but I do.
And what are the repercussions?
Yeah, you're going to go to camp longer and longer. Leadership camp.
Oh.
I add a week on, another week, two more weeks.
Interesting.
No.
Can she cook?
Yeah, she can, actually. She was filleting salmon at age 6.
Nice.
She tells me I can't. Mom, you really don't know how to cook.
Here, no.
Let me show you how to cook popcorn. That was at age 4. She put the little post-it stamp on the microwave and points it to the popcorn button because she...
Really?
Because I like to do it in the pot.
Right.
Oh, she's like my toughest critic. Like when I make pasta, if I leave... Yeah, I like a little pasta water in it. And if it's too much, she'll just walk by with a smile to the sink and empty it out.
Nice. That's humbling.
She loves to cook. Yeah. So, and lately she's just been... cooking with me a lot when I'm home because I haven't been home lately.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Because of travel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, my son likes to cook too, but he's fearless. I think like the younger cooks they've watched so much cooking on TV.
Yeah.
They've experienced so much. They've gone to so many different kinds of restaurants that are casual, but have all these cuisines and flavors. And they just feel like, I'll figure it out. Yeah. I mean, that's been my...
She's kind of like me too. It's like she'll go... When she was young, I took her out and she's like, the server came over and he said, well, what would you like? She's like, well, I'll have the pasta. He's like, well, we don't have that, but we have spaghetti. She's like, well, that's pasta. I'm like, oh, fuck. Shut. Zip it.
That's awesome.
Mm.
All right. I'm going to swing into our lightning round.
Oh, what's that?
I'm going to just ask you kind of a series of this or that type questions.
Okay.
And you just have to imagine this is like forever.
Forever?
Forever.
No, that's forever.
I know, but just for, you know.
That's a tattoo.
Oysters or crudo?
Oysters.
Great.
Forever.
Spaghetti or rigatoni?
Oh, God. All right, spaghetti.
When we did the carbonara, it was the rigatoni.
Well, that's, you know.
It's one of the two.
You're making me, you know.
I know.
Decide here.
Yep, I am. Red Sox or Celtics?
Sox.
Fresh or dried pasta?
Fresh.
Do you feel like any home cook could make dried pasta?
Make dried pasta?
I'm sorry, make fresh pasta. Is this something any cook could do?
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. And should know how to do.
Well, you just have to practice a little.
Right. I'm trying to convince Adam to let us do a fresh pasta story. He's been very resistant. So I'm just working it all the time.
Adam, I'll show you how to do it.
Great.
Tricks of the trade.
There you go. Ben Affleck or Matt Damon?
Damon.
I hate Affleck. Butter or olive oil?
Butter.
Really?
It's another nickname.
Butter Lynch?
Butter.
Butter and Knuckles.
Butter.
See, you have to like have had an interesting life to end up with nicknames like that.
I make butter soup. Butter.
Butter. All right, that's it. Butter right. With Barbara Lynch. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Emma Wertzman and Carrie Polis and edited by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and LeGrady's, with additional music by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.